Hi, everybody. Those of you who have participated in classes of mine before know that I have this fortunate propensity to get bogged down in the middle and to concentrate on the earlier sources, and occasionally have to just simply either skip the later sources or just try to encapsulate them. So I figured out a strategy to deal with that. And the strategy is to start with the end. So if you have the sources that I sent in, I'm starting now on the third page from the end. So that way we'll be able to do the last three pages of sources at the beginning, and therefore, if we don't ever get past the fourth page, we will still have covered everything. So as you can see, hopefully on the screen in front of you, what I have posted here are several versions of the illustrious Fir Kashis, right? The four questions, the Manishtana. The earliest version that we have ostensibly comes from the Mishnah. I say ostensibly for reasons that I will clarify. And it's pretty much, well, take a look at it yourselves. If I might hum in the background, the children's song about one of these things is not like the others. One of these things just doesn't belong. Can you see which one is not like the others before I finish my song? And you can see that three of the four questions are pretty much the standard ones, the conventional ones. One, however, is different. I've color-coded them, right? The opening question deals with chametz and matzah. The second question deals with sha'ar yirakot and maror. The fourth question deals with tibul, with tvilah. And it's the third question that we're not accustomed to. The third question, according to the Mishnah, is shebechol halelot anu ochalim bisar tzli shaluk u'mivushal, that on all other nights, we eat a variety of different meats prepared different ways. It can be boiled, that is, cooked, potted. It can be roasted. Okay, halayla hazeh, on this night, the night of Pesach, kulo tzli. Now, not only is this different insofar as that it's not part of our conventional manishtana, it's different because the prevalent custom nowadays and has been for a while is not to eat roasted meat at the seder. So here we have something that's odd in two respects. One, it's not what we're accustomed to. And two, it seems actually to be somewhat iconoclastic. It seems to be in defiance of convention. Now, a way to understand it is to say that the Mishnah here has captured the text of the Manishtana as it was recited during the time that the temple was still standing. And therefore, the people who would say, on every night we can prepare meat however we wish, but on tonight we eat only roasted meat, were in fact referring to the actual Korban Pesach, which had to be roasted, and according to Torah law, could not be potted. Okay? So then, it would explain to us at least why it preserves this version of Tzli that we have discarded. But that addresses the second problem. The first problem was, what about convention? How do you have four questions if one of them is no longer operable? So first of all, let's just
Could that have been performance rather than teaching?
Pardon me?
Could the reciting that question about Basar Tzli have been speech performance rather than teaching?
I'm not sure I know exactly what you mean by that distinction.
Performance. After we were not able to eat Basar Tzli anymore, at least we can perform the act by teaching, by reading the Mishnah.
Okay. Now, I thank you for that clarification. Hold that thought. We'll get to it very shortly. Okay. Let's look now at the next version of the Manishtana. Very difficult to date it relative to the first one. It comes from the Talmud Yerushalmi, but that doesn't mean that it isn't Tanaitic in origin. So take a look, and if you see the color coding, right, you can see right away that there are, again, two problems with this version of the four questions. The very first problem being that there aren't four questions. Okay? Notice, right, there are only three items here in the Yerushalmi version of the Manishtana, right? We retain the question about dipping. We retain the question about matzah, okay? It retains the question about tzli, roasted meat, but it seems in the process to have lost the question about maror, which is a problem, right? Because maror would arguably be one of the three most critical and indispensable elements of the Seder, right? Kol shelo amar shlosha dvarim ela ba-pesach lo yatza yedei chovato. Anybody who doesn't address these three items has not fulfilled an obligation. Umahem, what are the three items? Pesach, matzah, and maror. So arguably, the question about tzli addresses Pesach. The question about matzah, right? But not to have a question, not to have, whether it's a question or a statement, not to have something addressing maror, right, is problematic, okay? From here we jump from the time of the Talmud to the Middle Ages, and we get the codification of the laws of the Seder in Maimonides' Mishneh Torah. And notice again what he has. His version, right, retains the tevilah, it retains the matzah, it restores the maror, but all of a sudden it has substituted for the fourth question, and it has replaced the Mishnah's question about tzli with a different question, and that is the one that we're going to deal with now, and that is the one about the posture that we assume during the Seder. And the last source that I brought here, if you can't read my funny Hebrew, it's as Maxwell House. That's obviously just simply the personification of the Haggadah of Pesach. And notice again that our version is the same as that of Rambam. So arguably, from the 12th century, from Rambam's codification of the laws of the Seder through the 21st century, we seem to be doing pretty well. That is to say, pretty much for the course of a millennium, right, we've had four standard statements or questions in the Manishtana. It goes back to the question of whether the particle ma is an interrogative particle or an exclamation. As in fact is the word how in English. How can introduce an interrogative. It can introduce a question, right? But it can also be an exclamation, okay? It isn't just the four questions. How is this night different? It could be four statements. How is this night different? Or in any event. So, as I said, for a millennium, we've been pretty much stable, okay? But the question is, what about, so notice, as I said, that the question about reclining, about Heseba, seems to have replaced the one regarding Tzli, which would make sense, as I said, since the prevailing custom for as long as we can remember has been to not to have roasted meat at the Seder. So arguably, once people stopped eating roasted meat at the Seder, if they wanted to retain four questions or statements, they had to substitute. So the substitution was Heseba for Tzli. That would simply raise the question of when did the convention change and when did people stop eating roasted meat at the Seder? I suggested previously that that would be a consequence of the destruction of the temple in 68 of the Common Era, and that once there was no longer an actual Korban Pesach, people then perhaps, as kind of like Zecher La Mikdash, to simply maintain a distinction between pre- and post-Korban Jewish life, the decision was made, we can imitate the Korban Pesach to a certain extent, but not to the full extent. And therefore, the requirement of eating the Korban Pesach roasted was changed. Now I'm going to show you that it's possible that the custom didn't change until the Middle Ages. The link is here for those of you who are interested. This is a, as you can well see, a handwritten Haggadah. It's a manuscript Haggadah. It is arguably the oldest extant Haggadah. It was retrieved from the Cairo Geniza, and it is considered to be, it is reliably dated to the 10th century. Okay? So it is over a millennium old. Okay? Now, the Cairo Geniza, interestingly, was discovered in a synagogue that, when it functioned as a synagogue 1,000 years ago, was a synagogue that catered to a community which, even though it was living in the capital of Egypt, conducted itself according to the rules and the rituals of the land of Israel. If we were to give it a name today, it would be called the Palestinian Synagogue of Fustat. That is to say, that it was a Beit Knesset, a synagogue that followed, as I said, the rules and the rituals of Eretz Yisrael, as opposed to other Jewish communities which generally followed the practices, the rites, and the rituals of Bavel, of the Jewish community in Iraq and Babylonia. Okay. So notice here on the third line. Okay, you can read it. It's eminently legible, especially since you know what you're looking for. You can see the words Manishtana. Okay, I don't know if you can see my cursor, but I'm placing it under the word Manishtana. Okay. Halayla hazeh mikol halaylot. Okay. So far, so good. Shebechol halaylot anu, here, matbilin pa'amachat. Right. So they opened with the question of matbilin, which, if I went back to the previous page, right, you would see is actually the way that the Talmud Yerushalmi starts. And it's also the way that, okay, let's go back to see, Talmud Yerushalmi starts with Matbilim, and so does Maimonides. Okay? After all, Maimonides lived in Cairo. Okay? Now, so Matbilim, Pa'amachat, see, they had no room on the line, so they put it here in the margin. Halayla hazeh, okay, sorry, halayla hazeh, shetei pe'amim. Okay, so far it's completely consistent with the Talmud Yerushalmi and with Maimonides. Let's go on. Okay, shebechol halaylot, anu ochlim, last line on the page, chametz u'matzah, okay, halayla hazeh, difficult to, it's a little faded here, kulo matzah. So far, so good. That's the second question in both the Yerushalmi and in Maimonides. Okay? Next page. Shebechol halaylot, anu ochlim, basar, tzli, shaluk umivushal, halayla hazeh kulo tzli. Entirely consistent with the Yerushalmi, but now differing from Rambam, from Maimonides. Now, that this Haggadah is entirely consistent with the ruling of the Talmud Yerushalmi is, as I said, consistent with the fact that the synagogue in which the Cairo Geniza was stored was a synagogue that, when it was in use as a synagogue, was in use by Jews who, despite the fact that they were living in the diaspora, nevertheless followed the rites and the rituals of Eretz Yisrael as opposed to the rites and rituals of Bavel. So that they kept the text of the Yerushalmi and had not, like Rambam, altered the text, okay, makes sense. But is the fact that they kept Tzli an indication that here in the 10th century in Egypt they were still eating Tzli? Or is it only an indication that they paid lip service, literally, lip service to their Yerushalmi traditions, whereas if you had been able to sit at one of their Seder tables, they would not have been serving you roasted meat. Okay. That, as I said, brings us to Rambam and to our contemporary Haggadah, which clearly have replaced Tzali with the question of Heseba, of reclining. That can take us back now to the first page of the sources, where we first encounter the term, and that is again in the Mishnah in Psachim, the same perek from which we previously saw the Manish Tana, the 10th perek of Masechet Psachim, called Arvei Pesachim, right? Things that pertain to the first night of Pesach, okay? And here the Mishnah tells us, Arvei Pesachim Samoch L'mincha, that when it gets evening time on the 14th day of Nisan, Lo Yochal Adam Ad She'techshach, right? That one does not sit down to the Seder meal until it is dark outside, right? Even though on Shabbat and on other Yamim Tovim, right, you can start the meal before sunset or before, at least before Tzeit HaKochavim, okay? On the night of Pesach, the Seder, right, has to begin only after it is dark outside. Okay. And then it adds, Va'afilu ani shebi Yisrael, even the poorest Jew, lo yochal ad she yasev. This isn't a question now of the timing. This is a question of the circumstance. And as I called it before, the posture that you assume at the Seder table. The Mishnah dictates that everybody, including poor people, when they sit down to their Seder meal, after it has already gotten dark on the night of the 15th of Nisan, the meal cannot be consumed unless one is reclining. Now, I highlighted the translation recline because in phrasing the topic for today, I called it, do you have the inclination? Because part of the question is, and the Gemara addresses it immediately, is just what is heseva? Is it inclination? Is it to incline? Or is it to recline? Now, just make sure we all understand what the difference is between inclining and reclining. Okay? Inclining means leaning to one side. Okay? Reclining isn't just leaning to the side. Reclining is actually lying down on one side. And the Gemara makes that clear immediately. It's the next text. Prakdan, supine. Okay? La shme heseba. Right? Meaning to lie down flat on your back is not reclining. I mean, it's not the form of reclining that is required by the Mishnah. Hesebat yamin. Leaning all the way, reclining on your right side, even if you recline properly, is still lashma haseba, is not again the kind of reclining that the Mishnah requires. Velo oden, moreover, shema yakdim kanele veshet viavoli de sakana. that if you lean to the right, then you're putting yourself in physical danger because the food that you put into your mouth might go down the windpipe instead of going down the gullet. Okay? Therefore, if you don't recline on your back and you don't recline on your right, then what's left? Clearly, by implication, you have to recline on your left side. Okay. So now the question is, does everybody have to recline? So the Mishnah asks, Isha etzel ba'ala, a woman in the presence of her husband, is she obligated to recline? Nope. Says, lo ba'aya heseba. She is not obligated to recline. Arguably leaving it open as an option, right? She's not obligated to recline. However, ve'im isha chashuvahi. If, however, she is an important woman, and clearly in the presence of her husband, she is an important woman in her own right, and not just an important woman because her husband is important, then tzricha heseba. Then such a woman, it isn't even just an option. For her, it is a requirement, as much of a requirement as it is for her husband. Ben etzel aviv. What about a child in the presence of his father? The Gemara says, Ba'i haseba, right? A child in the presence of his father similarly is obligated to recline. Now, what do we get from all of this? What's the question that they're asking? The question they're asking is, what does reclining, what does haseba accomplish? And by asking, does a woman need to recline in the presence of her husband? Does a child need to recline in the presence of his father? Or in the continuation, Talmid etzel rabo mai, a student in the presence of his teacher, of his master, right? What it's doing is it's telling us that haseba, reclining, is a function of social relationships. And therefore the question is, does the requirement to recline change if the social relationship is different? Okay. The Gemara continues, and in response to the question of does a student need to recline if he is having his seder in the presence of his teacher, the Gemara says, Tashma, we have a proof. The Amar Abaye, right, one of the leading Amoraim, Ki Havinan Be Mar, that when we as students were present for the Seder at the home of our teacher, Ziginan Abirche Dahadade, we would recline. Obviously, they were sitting packed together because there were obviously numerous students. So they couldn't recline in the sense of completely leaning over, but they were nevertheless able to lean slightly so that they were supporting themselves. Each one was supporting himself by leaning on the lap of the person sitting next to him. Okay. However, Ki atina levei Rav Yosef, when, however, we came to the home of a different teacher, Amarlan, he told us, lo tzrichto. You don't need to recline. Mora rabach ki mora shamayim. Because the awe that is inspired in you by your teacher is essentially the awe that is inspired to you by heaven, by God. Now, what does that tell me? It tells me that reclining is a function of the relationship that you have with someone above you. And that if that relationship is one of equality, then you're obligated to recline. If, however, the relationship is one of inferiority, then you're not obligated to recline. So if reclining is a function of equality rather than inferiority, this already gives me the key to understanding the reason behind reclining. And that is that it is considered a posture of free people. Therefore, if you're sitting around a table and you are of equal social status with everybody else around the table, then you are as free as they are, and therefore all of you are obliged to recline. If, however, you're seated around the table and somebody else at the table is a social superior to you, as either, at least in those days, a husband generally was to his wife, or clearly that a master was to his student or to his disciple, or that a parent was to a child, then because the relationship was not one of complete equality, then you could not demonstrate your freedom by reclining, and therefore reclining was no longer an obligation, it was only an option to exercise. And indeed, as we see, this was codified as Jewish legal practice in the Torah and subsequently in the Shulchan Aruch. Just to save us some time, we can read it in English. One's table should be set from the previous day, meaning one should not delay the setting of the table until one comes home from shul on the first night of Pesach. Why? In order to be able to eat as soon as it gets dark. I almost annually cite this halacha in conversation with rabbis who seem to feel that it's perfectly okay to keep people in shul the first night of Pesach beyond this limit. In any event, one should set the table on the previous day. Previous day means the afternoon of the 14th, okay? So that one, when one returns from shul and it is dark, one can start the meal promptly. Even if he is in the study hall, he should exit it because it is a mitzvah to hasten and to eat. Why? So that the children do not fall asleep. Okay? If you come back, if Mariv stretches out in shul, and if when you get back from shul, you first set the table, and then you start with the Haggadah, and of course, the Haggadah gets punctuated frequently by everybody's contributions, particularly those of children who have learned and memorized them in school, right? Then by the time you get to the meal, right, the odds are very good that children will already be sleepy. However, one should not eat before it turns dark, even though on an ordinary Shabbat or holiday, one may add to the sacred time. Pesach is different. I mentioned this before, because the time to eat matzah is only at night, as indeed that was the time that was prescribed for the Korban Pesach. Continuing, one should set the table with nice utensils to the best of his ability and prepare the seat that he will occupy reclining. And here we get the description of it. You can see that it's highlighted here in the text, right? Derech Chevrot. So that the Torah has already inferred from the Gemara's discussion of what qualifies as reclining, that reclining, that assuming a posture of reclining is an indication of freedom. As I said, of at least in our terms, we would call it of social equality. However, he makes an observation that the Avi Ezri, that would be the Raviyah, a 13th century Ashkenazic scholar, wrote that nowadays, when it is not customary in our lands to recline, one may sit in the ordinary fashion and there is no obligation to recline. Right? Put that again. Nowadays, okay, and this is already in the 12th or 13th century, okay, when it is not customary in our lands, that would be, right, Europe, okay, to recline, then reclining is no longer a posture that is synonymous with freedom. Because if nobody reclines, right, if everybody sits upright at the table, then that in itself is a way of distinguishing yourself as being a ben chorin, of being a free person, because that's the way free people ordinarily sit at the table. if the point of reclining is that you're in a social situation in which you demonstrate your social status by reclining, then you have to recline at the Seder because you want to give a visible, tangible sign of your appreciation of your redemption from Egypt. If, however, reclining is not a posture that's ordinarily assumed by people, then the Rav Yehuda ruled it is no longer obligatory.
Where did Rav Yehuda live?
As I said, he's lived, I believe it's the 12th or 13th century in Germany.
Germany.
Yeah. If one reclines, again, he's saying that it isn't obligatory, but it remains an option. If one reclines, he should not be supine. That's where we saw that in the Gemara, okay? Nor prone. I think prone probably rules itself out because very difficult to eat if you're lying on your face, okay? Nor on his right side, but only on the left, okay? And further, he tells us that Rashbam, who wrote a commentary on Arvei Pesachim, explained that it is to eat with his right hand. The reason you lean to your left is because you feed yourself with your right hand. Therefore, a lefty, right, should recline on his right side. Okay. Rashi, however, gave the reason that one should not choke, right? The idea that if you lean to your right, your food might go down your windpipe instead of going down the gullet. In which case, if Rashi indeed is correct, then of course, there should be no difference between one is right-handed and one is left-handed. Everybody should be leaning to the left. Now, addressing the question about a woman in the presence of her husband, is she obligated to recline? The Torah says a woman does not have to recline. Rashbam, again, in his commentary in the Talmud, explained that it is because she is subservient to her husband. As I said, if indeed it's a reflection of social status, then the status of a woman vis-a-vis her husband is the same as that of a child vis-a-vis a parent, or that of a student vis-a-vis a teacher, and therefore, haseba, reclining is not an obligation. Okay? In that case, he points out, a widow or a divorcee, that is a woman who does not have a man seated at her table to whom she is socially subservient, okay, would have to recline. The Bahag, that would be the Baal Halachot Gedolot, a Gaonic authority in an even earlier century, probably the 9th century, wrote that it is because a woman does not customarily pour wine, in which case, no woman needs to recline. So he's giving it not so much a social significance as he's giving it a practical significance, meaning that the reason that one leans over is not necessarily during the mealtime per se, but that leaning is a function of drinking the four cups. As does a son seated at his father's table, even if his father is his teacher. A student does not have to recline in the presence of his teacher, even if it is not his regular teacher, unless he is given permission to do so. And his concluding statement addresses a waiter, who obviously is a Jewish waiter, okay, needs to recline, meaning when he observes his own Seder meal, he is obligated to recline. And anyone who is obliged to recline and eats or drinks without reclining, the halacha says the Torah, lo yatsa yedecho vato, has not met his obligation. Now, let's just see again how this played itself out in some of the sources that we saw previously. Remember that in the Yerushalmi, we saw that there were three questions. And the questions were tevila, matbilin, chametzu matzah, and, you remember? Okay, let's take a quick look to remind ourselves, and tzli. Okay, so ostensibly, the Yerushalmi did not address the question of heseba. So what does the Yerushalmi say? Amar Rabbi Levi, l'fisha derech avadim liyot ochelim me'umad, that since it was customary in those days for servants to take their meals while standing, arguably because they were eating at the same time that the Seder was going on, and therefore they needed to be literally on their feet in order to be able to serve their functions during the Seder. Okay. V'chan lihiyot ochlin misubin. Okay. Here, however, even though it was their practice ordinarily to remain standing during a meal at which they were in service, when it comes to the Seder, their own Seder, they're obligated to recline. Because even though they're now, so to speak, by being waiters at a Seder, they are in service to somebody else, right? That's only a temporary thing. That's only a tentative thing. And therefore, in their own Seder, they're obligated to recline. And Raimonides, who similarly, who now we know, he substituted the Heseba for Tzli in his version of the Manishtana, wrote, Lefichach, right, therefore, Kshesoed Adam Balayla Hazeh, that when one takes one Seder meal, Tzarich Le'echol Vilishtot, both the eating and the drinking take place, v'hu may save derech chayrut. Again, the emphasis that reclining is a demonstration of one's social status, of one's independence, of one's freedom. I like independence better now. The word didn't come to me before. And again, going back to the Talmud Bavli, Amar Reb Yoshua ben Levi, Nashim chayavot bi'arba'a kosot halalo. That women are obligated in the arba'a kosot. Now, it's things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. Okay? If, according to Maimonides' codification of the law, the only way that you fulfill your obligation in drinking four cups is if you drink them while you're reclining, okay? And if B, right, women bear the same obligation to drinking the four cups as is borne by men, then, ergo, if men only fulfill their obligation in the Arba Kosot by drinking them while reclining, then women too only fulfill their obligation in the Arba Kosot if they drink them while reclining. Therefore, implicitly, women too, at least for the drinking of the four cups, would be obligated to recline. The She'iltot, again, a very early Gaonic work, maybe even as early as the 8th century, if not the 8th, certainly the 9th century. Ishai Natsricha Haseba. Again, that's the early ruling that women are not obligated to recline. Maitama, why? Lav Darka di Nashe Lemazga. Going back to the line that we saw in the tour, because it is not customary for women to pour wine. V'isha chashuvah, if however she is an important woman, tzricha heseba. I'm not sure whether it's the physical act of pouring the wine that he has in mind, or whether it's the question of whether women traditionally partook of wine during a meal. Because again, there seems to be a specific link between reclining and drinking the four cups. So I don't know whether the point of that, it's not the custom of women to pour wine, doesn't mean that women go around and pour wine for everybody at the table. If that were the case, why would they have the shamash? Why would they have the waiter? But I think it's talking about a woman pouring wine for herself. Okay. Finally, we have the clincher in this discussion, which is a statement made by the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, 16th century Poland, whose notes, if you wish, strictures on the Shulchan Aruch, modify certain laws to bring them in line with the customs of Ashkenazic Jewry, as opposed to those of Sephardic Jewry, which are reported in the Shulchan Aruch proper. And here, apropos of the question of whether women are obligated to recline or not, he makes a statement that says, Kol hanashim shelanu mikre chashuvot. Right? He makes a blanket statement. He says, the earliest source that we consulted said that an important woman is obligated to recline. He says, in our communities, all women have the status of important women, and therefore, by implication, all women would be obligated to recline. Okay? Ach, however, he says, you knew that was coming. Lo nahagu lahasev. It simply did not become customary for women to recline during the Seder. Why? Ki samchu al divrei ra'aviya dechatav debizman hazeh ein lahaseg. Going back to our 12th, 13th century authority, the Ra'aviya, who ruled that since eating while reclining is no longer customary at all, right? Then it's a meaningless custom. And if it's a meaningless custom, then there really is no point in qualifying the question of who is obligated in a meaningless custom and who is not. Now we come back to the point that I made at the beginning when I translated the very first line on the very first page as recline as opposed to incline. How in fact do we know that Haseba was reclining and not just inclining? After all, you can incline to the left, right? That would be just simply leaning, right? As opposed to reclining, which would really mean that the entire left flank of your body would be repositioned, right, horizontally. Okay, meaning inclining is somewhat between vertical and horizontal. It's kind of a diagonal position, right? Whereas reclining would be completely horizontal. How do we know that? So here it is. It's reflected in an early source, the Tosefta. The Tosefta was a collection of Tanaitic statements, some of which were subsequently incorporated into the Mishnah, and others remained independent of the Mishnah, but they indeed reflect conditions and circumstances that prevailed during the time that the temple was still standing. And in describing the conduct of the Seder, of a meal, it asks the following question. Ketzad Seder Seuda. Now, this is a tricky one, because the word Seder here shouldn't be capitalized. And you notice it isn't translated as Seder with a capital S. Here the word Seder is a common noun. It means an order. After all, we know, why is the meal at the first night of Pesach called a Seder? Because it runs according to a preset schedule, right? Kadesh, Urchatz, Karpas, Yachatz, etc., etc. So because it runs in an order, it's called the order, the Seder, okay? So the word Seder here with a lowercase s, okay, simply means the order. So the Tosefta is asking an interesting question. It's asking a question about etiquette in general. Ketzad Seder Seuda. Is there a proper Jewish way to conduct a meal? And it says as follows. Orchim, guests, right? Because we're not talking about an ordinary meal where it's just the family sitting together around the table, right? We're talking about a festive meal, a meal at which company is invited, okay? So the company enters. V'yoshvim asaf salim, they sit on benches, val gabe katedraot, or on chairs, okay? Ad sheyitkansu, meaning they're waiting for all of the people who are going to participate in the meal to arrive. Nitkansu kulan, when all of the invited guests have arrived. I don't know if you saw last night, I think there was a state dinner in the White House, okay? So if you saw, you know, the president is there and the guest of honor, and then there's a receiving line, right? So it takes time for all of the guests to come, okay? So, nitkansu kulam, when finally all of the guests have arrived, natnu lahem liyadayim, they're given water with which to wash their hands. But hold on a second. This isn't the washing of the hands that you're thinking of. Or it is, if you bear in mind that in the Seder of Pesach night, there are two instances in which we wash our hands. And I don't, if you thought about it, the first one is Urachatz, the second one is Rachatza. The first one is a washing of the hands that, according to the notes in my Haggadah, only the one who's conducting the Seder needs to wash his hands. Okay? Whereas the rachtza is everybody seated around the table has to wash. Why? Because the second washing is in preparation, anticipation of eating bread. The first washing is only in anticipation of eating a vegetable. Now, Where did that all come from? Comes from here. Kol echad ve'echad notel yado achat. At this juncture in the meal, everybody only has to wash one of their two hands. Mazgulahem et hakos. And then if somebody pours them a cup of wine, kol echad ve'echad mevarech la'atzmo. Everybody makes an individual bracha, meaning this isn't yet the meal, right? This is all kind of like the preamble to the meal. Heviu lifnehem parpraot, and indeed they brought all sorts of crudités. Kol achad ve'achad mevarech la'atzmo. It's still a point at which everybody is making individual bracha. Now go on, see the next paragraph. Alu ve'hesebu. What's the next stage in the conduct of a formal, of a festive or formal meal? You relocate. You go upstairs. Meaning, all of this is taking place in the foyer, so to speak, right? In the entrance to the home on the ground level. Now, everybody moves up to the second floor, the Heisebu, where they, now they're going to take, partake of the essential meal itself, and therefore at this point in time, they recline. V'natnu lahem liyadayim. Now they're given water again. Af apisha natal yado achat, now notel shtei yadav. And just as we do on the Seder, right? Even though we have washed previously, before eating the karpas, we wash again now. Mazgulahem et hakos. And now when the wine is poured, af apisha berech al harishon, mevarech al hasheni. In answer to the question of why it is that we make brachot on every one of the four kosot, even though according to the sequence of the meal, the second cup, there's no interruption, so to speak, after the first one. Nevertheless, it continues. So what's the point here? The point is that we see from the Mishnah in Avot, which is here on the next page, okay, that I've highlighted now, okay, that these two places, the one downstairs that I call the foyer, where the hors d'oeuvres were served, was called the prosdor, while the upstairs room, where the meal was served, was called the traklin. Both of these are Greek words. Prosdor, as you see from Jastrow's dictionary, is a veranda or a vestibule or a foyer. Okay. The traklin is a room in which you find the banqueting couch. So that the first part of the meal was conducted while people were either seated, either on benches or on chairs, meaning they were seated upright. Okay? That was the prosdor. When they went upstairs to the traklin to partake of the major part of the meal, the first thing they did was they reclined on couches. And by the way, this, became an aphorism in the name of Rabbi Yaakov. Ha'olam hazeh, this world, domeh leprosdor, right? It's the, that's just the world that we're living in now, that's just the foyer, the vestibule, right? The real, the essential world, that takes place only in the traklin. So Rabbi Yaakov has a very good piece of advice. He says, hatken atzmecha beprosdor, prepare yourself while you're still in the vestibule, kedesh tikanes letraklin, so that you know how to conduct yourself properly when you get elevated to the traklin. And here we have a picture of a traklin. Now, if you think about it, okay, traklin, if you break it down as a Greek word, kind of sounds as though it's something with a prefix of tri, right? Something to do with three, right? And indeed, it may very well be that they were three-legged. These were special three-legged couches. But in any event, you see here, here is a picture of a triclinium, a formal dining room in a Roman building. The word itself, the triclin, adopted from the Greek triclinium, tri meaning three, right? And cline, a sort of couch, or rather a chaise longue, because you see that they were set up in groups of three. So arguably, this is the style of eating that was introduced into the land of Israel in the first century of the Common Era by the Romans, right? And it became the model, right, for formal dining. Therefore, since the meal on the first night of Pesach, the Seder, is the most formal and most festive meal that we conduct throughout the whole year, because it's the one that marks our social status as Bnei Chorin, as being independent, therefore the rabbis decided to adopt some of the trappings that they associated with formal festive meals as they had witnessed their conduct by the Romans. Which explains to us, of course, why by the 12th or 13th century in Europe, it was no longer the practice. And that's why the Ravia was able to rule that since it may have once been the practice and it may once have been the model for a formal or festive meal, and in that case, the question of who is or is not obligated to recline were pertinent questions. By the Middle Ages, apparently, it was no longer so. That it has resumed that importance nowadays, so that at an ordinary family seder, you still see people leaning, not necessarily reclining, but still leaning, may be a compromise. It may be both a physical compromise and an historical compromise. It's a physical compromise because inclining, as I said, is yet still not sitting upright, but not completely horizontal. And it's an historical compromise because it's not what the Romans did, and it isn't the complete absence of what the Romans did. So that leaning to the left, not reclining, but leaning to the left, would seem to be a golden mean between the two extremes.
But is it possible that the triclinium is the origin of the three questions of the Manishtana? This Manishtana introduces the...
Very, very, very doubtful. Very doubtful. There were probably originally five questions, just as there were probably originally five sons, and we certainly know that there were originally five cups of wine. It seems that over the course of time, a decision was made, either all at once or gradually, to distinguish the historical Seder from the generational Seder, by reducing everything from five to four. So I think that there were originally five questions, and somehow it got reduced to four, but the question of which four is we've taken just a stab at it. Destruction of the Second Temple was in 68 of the Common Era, not in 70. Sorry about that, but if you want to know how I know, then just put a mark on your calendar for this coming Tisha B'Av to go for the night of Tisha B'Av to the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue on 70th Street in Central Park West in Manhattan in New York, where at the conclusion of the service, they recite very formally, Ba'avonoteinu HaRabim, that due to our manifold sins, there have elapsed so and so many years since the destruction of our temple, and they are counting clearly from the year 68 of the Common Era. The problem with the number 70 is simply that it was calculated by people who actually thought that the distance from between the year 1 before the Common Era and the year 1 of the Common Era was 2 years, whereas it wasn't 2 years. There was no year zero. So the first year before the Common Era went immediately into the first year of the Common Era. And that accounts for the discrepancy between 68 and 70.
Who was the fifth son?
Well, think about it. What's missing? You have a Chacham and a Rasha and a Tam. Mm-hmm. And a Sheno Yodea Lishol. What's missing? What's the opposite of Chacham? It's not a Rasha. It's a Tipesh. Okay.
Yeah, a fool? No,
Yep.
We cannot call Jewish children fools.
Maybe that's why they eliminated it.
But
okay. How does one drink without spilling one? I mean,
one
what is
it
reclined? Carefully, very carefully.
No, Dr. Sokol, if I may, I'm pretty sure the Talmud Yerushalmi refers to the child that we call the Thomas a Tipesh.
Yeah,
so
I'm saying,
it probably
I'm saying
was in our source.
I'm saying,
And then,
of course, yeah, I'm saying that there clearly is reason to say that at some point in time, the basic elements in the Seder came in fives. And that there was a deliberate attempt after the Churban to cut it down to four. But any event, okay, that's it.
There's one question. Hold on, I don't know why my video went off, but I wanted to know why. I think somebody wrote, "How do you drink without spilling wine if you're reclining?"
I wrote carefully. I said carefully, very carefully.
Okay, that's it. Okay. All right. Thank you. I just posted if I am for Yom Iyun, of course, on Sunday. Beginning at 9:50 Eastern time. I think we have a stellar lineup. Our partners here tonight is given by Asher Finkelstein, a young, very prominent Talmud Chacham. It's Rabbi Rosenzweig's son-in-law. And it's a major young Talmud Chacham. He'll be making his debut on Torah Motion this evening. Tomorrow, 9:15, we'll be continuing my class on the Seder. We're just beginning the Amidah, the first Baruch in the Shmon Esrei. And then, of course, Sundays are Yom Iyun. Next week, we'll have every day at 1 o'clock. And on Tuesday, we'll have back-to-back. We'll have a doubleheader of Shiurim on all week. And we look forward to learning with you. And like I say, the Sunday Yom Iyun, that will keep you busy on Sunday. Lots to discuss on Pesach. Okay, everybody.
Jay?
Any other comments, questions, suggestions, please let me know. And we look forward to seeing you soon. And thank you, Dr. Sokolow.
A pleasure. Jay, I have an offer to make to you.
I assume everybody does leave you.
I have an offer.
I'm
regarding
sorry?
The Amidah.
Okay.
Yeah. If you're open to it,
I'm sorry. Go.
If you're open to it, when you're done, I would welcome an opportunity to talk to your audience about the historical development of the Amidah, how we came to 19 brachot instead of
so
seven.
What we did in our last. That's the transition from Anshei Knesset Agdola to Shimon HaPakuli. I mean, you can listen. That's what we
I'm not about. Talking about 18 to 19. I'm
yeah,
talking about 17.
I understand.
Yeah.
The beautiful interpretation of Rav Kook on why Shmuel HaKatan was the one to compose the 19th bracha. We will not say that here because we want to encourage people to come, but really very, very beautiful. Are you aware of his interpretation, Rav Kook's interpretation? That's very, very beautiful. Anyway, I don't think we're going to talk about that in tomorrow's
It's not impossible that the Tosefta, which talked about the triclinium, also had the three questions. You say that there were five originally, and then some reduced to four and to three, but maybe the version that the Tosefta was familiar with had three questions, and that's why it talks about triclinium.
I don't know why there has to be a fixed number of questions. The language.
It's not a question. It has to be. It's a tradition.
No. That's the tradition itself. There has to be an origin to a tradition. The idea about Keneged Arba'a Banim Dibra Torah is arbitrary. What the Gemara says is Kefi. I'm sorry. What's the language? The language. I have it here in the slide. The language is, Kafi Dato Shel Ben Aviv Melamdo. Now, that's open to considerably more than five possibilities. I think that's the source of it. But evidently, somebody wanted to codify it, so to speak. So they picked a number, but the number is arbitrary.
Okay, thank you. By the way, it probably would be quite a while till we finish the Shmon Esrei, but that's all. That's another.
I'm patient.
Yes, yes. Barkish.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Only lots to discuss, but okay.
Thank
See
you.
At 8:30 tonight, those who can make it, and then okay, as we progress, have a great day, everybody. Be well. Zorotova.